Please be seated. The second case for oral argument this morning is Doug Grantvoort, appellant, versus David Straithen, the appellee. For the appellants, we have Mr. Robert Trzinka and Mr. Daniel Brentro, attorneys from Sioux Falls. I understand, Mr. Trzinka, you'll be presenting this morning. All right, and for the appellee, we have Mr. Jason Sutton, also an attorney from Sioux Falls. So with that, Mr. Trzinka, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. At the end of the day, this court is asked to decide, or to ratify, more specifically, the actions of an attorney who didn't just passively sit by while his client was utilizing an eavesdropping device to spy on the opposing party in litigation, but he was asked, but what he did instead was to collect those recordings, collate them, organize them. He went over those recordings with his clients in preparation for trial. He had his staff take those recordings and cherry pick that data that would be embarrassing to the other party, which the attorney knew had no bearing on the issues to be decided by the court. And then not only once, twice, but three times tried to insert recordings that had been illicitly obtained in a court of law. The trial court ruled correctly that Doug had an expectation of privacy and that there was an intrusion into that expectation of privacy, but that there was a question over whether it was so seriously intrusive to offend the sensibilities of your average everyday person. The court granted summary judgment to defendant Straight on the grounds that he was not an active participant in this invasion of privacy. Rather, the court reasoned that the basis for the summary judgment was that he was merely a passive collector of evidence. And I think, judges and justices of the court, when we look at the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, which was the appellant, that is an error, and the trial court should be reversed.
Is it a factual call or a question of law?
I think it's a factual call regarding the level or the degree of his participation.
Well, but reading the briefs, it doesn't any argument that I got as to what happened. It's what does it mean?
Well, I think if the court wants to look at it at that point, I think that there is no question that he aided and abetted the plaintiff. And I think that summary judgment on an aiding and abetting theory against the appellee would be warranted, simply because his conduct was more than just someone who was passively sitting by. Rather, he was an active participant in the overall invasion of privacy against Doug Grantvoort. And one thing that I would note to the court is that the appellees, the defendant Straight, he characterizes his behavior in this case as typical. And he references typical several times throughout his brief as to what his behavior was. And one of the questions for this court, is it typical for an attorney to allow his client to eavesdrop on the opposing party? In this case, it's an eavesdropping device, but is it permissible for an attorney to allow his client to burglarize the opposing party? I don't think that it is. And I think that there's a serious concerns from a public policy standpoint if this court signs off on the idea that it's acceptable for an attorney to utilize evidence or try to utilize evidence gathered through either an eavesdropping device or other illicit means in a court of law. And that is the basis for the invasion of privacy claim against defendant Straight in this case. The defendant Straight argues that this case is the controlling authority on this case is Chem Age v. Glover, 2002 case, involving this court. Now, we didn't address the case directly in our briefing because primarily Chemage v. Glover dealt with aiding and abetting a breach of fiduciary duty. I would note for the court that at no point has the appellants or Doug claimed that Defendant Strait owed him any duty. There's no claim that Defendant Strait owed him any duty. And so this analysis about malpractice and the duties related to malpractice, I think, are inapplicable. But Chemage is on point as it pertains to what constitutes aiding and abetting in South Dakota. I would like to, first, it specifically recognizes Chemage, the Restatement of Torts, second, section 876, comment B, which talks about the theory of aiding and abetting. And in the restatement, it says, quote, "For harm resulting to a third person from the tortious conduct of another, one is subject to liability if he knows that the other's conduct constitutes a breach of duty and gives substantial assistance or encouragement to the other so to conduct himself," unquote. And so there's a disjunctive question that the court needed to answer. Did Defendant Strait either provide substantial assistance or encouragement? And
what was the substantial assistance in your view?
The substantial assistance was not just, if he was just sitting by and she brought in the evidence and he just sat on it, that would be one thing. But the other aspect of this is that he talked over that evidence with her. He tried to introduce it at trial. He cherry-picked evidence that he knew was not relevant to the legal issues, but instead was relevant to emotional desires that his client had, which was to embarrass Doug Gantford.
Well, the relevance may be minimal, but it was a suit for divorce. Grounds were disputed, adultery and extreme cruelty. Alimony was requested. And division of property. And it's my understanding from the record that his desire to introduce snippets of the tapes focused around the existence of the affair and his net worth. Is that correct?
Well, that is the argument that Defendant Strait's attorneys made. When I asked Defendant Strait about it, he gave a different answer. His testimony was that adultery wasn't at issue in the case. There was no dispute over whether or not there had been adultery. And he agreed when I asked him, and I gave him several outs to say that there was relevance to the matter. He said that it had no, and I quote, "no bearing whatsoever," unquote, on the legal issues of the case. But even if there was a bearing on the legal issues of the case, the California court in Kimmel v. Goland, 51 Cal 3rd 202, indicated that even if it were relevant to the issues of the case, it doesn't immunize an attorney from the underlying invasion of privacy against a third party. And that's because the fact of committing this invasion of privacy, or if his or her client committed the tort of invading someone's privacy by installing a recording device, as in Kimmel, or as in the Tolan case, where they had illicitly obtained messages that were being sent over instant messages, that those actions of getting information in an illicit manner is inconsistent with the power and duties and the responsibilities that are handed to us as members of the legal profession. And so by obtaining evidence in this illicit manner, they act outside of the scope of their duties as attorneys. And then, and so they are warranted no protection under those grounds.
I understand, Mr. Kucinka, your theory and your argument about Mr. Strait seeking to admit two or three times at the divorce trial the excerpts of these tapes. And you could look at that through the lens of the aider and abetter theory, because as I understand it, by that time, and maybe I'm incorrect, but by that time, Mr. Strait's client had long since ceased making the recordings. Am I right?
That's correct. I think there are two
points. Hang on. So how is that, if that is that the violation, And if that's a violation, is it over such that at trial, you know, is he substantially assisting or encouraging, or are the disputed facts of his substantial assistance or encouragement if the wrongful conduct is over?
Well, let me answer this in two different ways. Number one, under this court's analysis of what constitutes invasion of privacy, the conduct wasn't over if the private information is disseminated to third parties. And that's what went on in the Roth v. Farner-Bakken case. And specifically in Roth v. Farner-Bakken, there were three different actions that constituted the invasion of privacy. Number one was the opening of the other person's mail. Number two was the photocopying of the other person's mail. And number three was the dissemination of the other person's mail to other individuals within Farner-Bakken. And that's analogous in this case to the actions of Defendant Strait, because although Mary Ann Ranshaw committed the first action in that she obtained the illicit recordings through an eavesdropping device, it was Defendant Strait that made the copies of them. It was Defendant Strait that organized them, and it was Defendant Strait that attempted to disseminate them.
Does it matter that his attempts were unsuccessful?
Well, and I think there's a dispute in the record whether it was unsuccessful, because the trial record from the underlying divorce trial includes the offer of proof where he tried to put those into evidence.
So can you address the litigation privilege claim, and why should that not apply, at least to that last part of the conduct here?
Certainly, and I touched on that when I was talking about the California case, both the California case of Kimmel and the Texas case of Tolan.
But don't we have our own controlling authority in Janklow v. Keller?
And I would agree, Judge, that the Janklow factors, and actually I would suggest that the Janklow factors mirror the factors considered by the California Appellate Court in Kimmel. We look to whether or not it's traditionally within the scope of what an attorney would do. And I think if we have to look at that, is it traditional, or is it within the scope of what an attorney typically would do in a court of law to use information that is illicitly obtained? I mean, we have to make a decision, because if the court affirms here, what happened in this case will happen again. We have, and one of the things from a public policy standpoint is I would suggest that it's important to let other attorneys know that it is unacceptable if your client is eavesdropping on the other party or stealing evidence from the other side. We have all sorts of protections in place. I mean, for example, if there was a mediation at my office and someone put an eavesdropping device in my office to overhear conversations that I had with my client, that certainly wouldn't be acceptable. And I would hope that we wouldn't want that sort of information getting into the public sphere. And I would certainly hope also that we would not allow attorneys to even try and use that evidence absent some sort of way to hold the attorney accountable.
Well, I've wondered all along why this case is here and why it's not in front of the State Bar Disciplinary Board if it's a violation of the attorney's oath.
I don't disagree with the court. I don't disagree with you, Chief Justice. I think that this is an issue of not only of tortious conduct, but of disciplinary conduct. You know?
I want to turn your attention to the civil conspiracy claim.
Certainly.
What is the majority rule as to whether or not a lawyer may conspire with their client? And then I have a second question about your settlement with Mary. And if this matter is reversed, how you intend to proceed to trial?
Certainly. Well, let me first tackle the civil conspiracy. As it pertains to civil conspiracy, you know, there's a split of authority, and I couldn't tell you from looking at the law whether there's a clear majority rule on this issue. What I do know is that, and I would say this, I think it would set bad precedents for this court to suggest that an attorney cannot commit a civil conspiracy to either commit a tortious act or a fraudulent act. This court looked at similar conduct from sort of the mirror image of civil conspiracy, which is aiding and abetting in the Kemmage case. And I think because they're sort of mirror images of the same coin is that, you know, civil conspiracy says we agree to commit this tortious act against this third party. Whereas aiding and abetting says you are committing this tortious act against a third party, and I'm going to provide you substantial assistance related to that tortious act. And if this court has already recognized that an attorney can be held accountable for aiding and abetting, I think it's only logical that an attorney can also be held accountable for civil conspiracy. As for the evidence of civil conspiracy, and it was something that I forgot to address with Justice Salter's earlier question, is introducing the evidence at trial, I think, shows the mens rea requirement for a civil conspiracy or the meeting of the minds regarding the invasion of privacy.
So do you intend to prove Mary's invasion of privacy at trial?
I think
it's an underlying tort.
I think it is the underlying tort, and I think that is part of the underlying claim. I mean, we try joint tort freezer cases all the time, whether it's on a purely joint tort freezer liability standpoint or a civil conspiracy standpoint or an aiding and abetting theory standpoint. We try those cases all the time where we've settled out against one of the joint tort freezers. And so I don't think that there's any particular challenge or novel application of the law for trying a case against a joint tortfeasor under an aiding and abetting theory after we've settled with the other party.
I want to go back to the litigation privilege, and you know, you suggested that we look at whether or not this conduct was within the scope of what an attorney typically does in a court of law. And I wonder about how you draw a hard and fast line there, because that could, just the way that's phrased, could conceivably leave down quite a slippery slope. You know, what other types of attorney conduct would be captured then? You know, somebody knowingly introduces false testimony, obviously that's a disciplinary issue and it warrants disciplinary action. But it seems a little bit different question is whether the third party can get at that through tort liability.
Understood. I think that there is, and the court is correct, and Justice Vane, you are correct in saying that we do need to draw a distinction here. And I think one of the ways that we can draw a distinction is we look at what an attorney would attorney would typically be immunized at. So, for example, invading someone's privacy to steal evidence or to use a wiretap, that seems outside the range of what an attorney can or should do. Because an invasion of privacy, regardless of if it's in a court of law or not in a court of law, is an actionable tort. And if the attorney is participating actively in that actionable tort, then I think then the court can say, this is where the bright line is. For example, burglary. Certainly, I think that seems to be a case where we would draw that bright line.
So is this case distinguishable from Kimmel in that Strait's conduct did not occur at the inception? The client was already conducting the recording. He downloaded the recordings, or allowed his staff, rather, he didn't personally do it, but allowed his staff to do so, versus a situation in Kimmel where the attorney apparently was involved in the inception.
I think that the Tolbert case addresses that distinction in that I don't think that it matters whether the attorney comes into this at the outset or enters into the equation later. At the point that the attorney is actively involved in the collection, use, and dissemination of illicitly obtained recordings, I think that's where the liability starts. And I think that from, if we look at the court cases that have addressed this issue, I don't think that is very controversial. I think that what the courts have said is, again, it's outside the scope of what an attorney typically does. It's not normal behavior, nor is it behavior that courts would permit or find acceptable for an attorney to do. And so I think from that standpoint, we are within the same realms as both Kimmel and with Colbert. I hope that answers your question.
No, thank you.
Okay. The other aspect of this that I want to address is if we look at, and I want to draw back to the Kemmage case, in Kemmage, and I want to draw the court to paragraph 43, and it talks about the balancing of encouraging attorneys to have conversations with their clients with the need to prevent them from committing tortious acts. In paragraph 43, quote, "On the other hand, the privilege of rendering professional services not being absolute, lawyers should not be free to substantially assist their clients in committing tortious acts," unquote.
Your time has expired, Mr. Justice.
Thank you, Chief.
Thank you. Mr. Sutton, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
May it please the court, counsel. This case provides this court an opportunity to establish a bright line rule that we are not going to allow in litigation the opposing party to sue the other side's lawyer for simply providing legal services. Let's think about this. What is this case really about? Fundamentally, Doug Gantvort, the plaintiff, is suing his ex-wife's divorce lawyer because, in his opinion, Attorney Strait did not tell Marianne soon enough to stop recording. He's
kind of reminds me of the Eicher case, which is a attorney disciplinary case, but there this court admonished an attorney for practicing in-your-face litigation tactics where he threatened to sue the other attorney if the attorney didn't settle on very favorable terms and basically throw his client under the bus.
Chief,
that's what's happening here?
In my opinion, Chief Justice, I think that's an important distinction, as you've raised and as Justice Devaney has raised, regarding the disciplinary issues versus the civil liability issues that we're dealing with here. So, and I think that distinction has been recognized by this court. It's consistent with the preamble, the model rules of professional conduct. A violation of the rule does not establish civil liability. Outside the conflict arena, in the Barons versus Wedmore case, this court has never used the rules to establish civil liability. So I think those are different questions, and I think they should be different questions.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Sutton. You want to draw a bright line rule. Let's say the instance of what plaintiff's counsel gave us, which was a burglary. So the attorney says, yeah, go ahead and break into their house and get those documents because we need them. Rendering legal services. Why is that different than what you have here?
I think for purposes of liability analysis, it isn't. I think that fundamentally, for the policy reasons and the strict application of the privity rule, we should not recognize liability of the lawyer to the other side. I think discipline's completely different. I think that would clearly be a disciplinary issue, but I do not believe that for purposes of civil liability, that claim should be recognized. And frankly, that's different than the claim we have here under any circumstances.
So that, starting out on this bar, on this course, sort of a categorical immunity sort of theory that is what, sourced to the privilege?
I think the source is the duty. The privilege issue is a defense. And here let me explain the key aspect of this, Justice Salter, from my perspective and what I think this court has done in the past. Historically, this court has been very clear that a lawyer owes a duty to one person only, that lawyer's client. And that is the only person that can sue for providing incorrect legal advice, malpractice, which is really what this claim is.
But that duty is different than, say, the duty that everybody owes to not engage in intentional conduct, whether it's a conversion, an assault, I mean, that everybody owes that duty to one another. It's not unique to the attorney-client relationship.
But the key to that is my obligation as a lawyer not to assault someone isn't, as you indicated, based upon the attorney-client relationship. Here, and I think the dichotomy is, if the lawyer is providing legal services, there cannot be liability. And the reason is the policy reasons articulated by this court in ChemAge Industries and Frisky versus Hogan, that we will not deviate from that privity rule, except for one very narrow instance, which is when you're drafting an estate plan. And this court has been adamant about that because of the problems that are created. And this case is a classic example of the problems that are created when you start peeling back the envelope of what was the advice the lawyer gave the client. Are we going to get into the strategic decisions that are made in the courtroom and the lawyer to offer the exhibit? Is it appropriate for the lawyer to consider the cathartic effect of the client in offering exhibits? Those are the questions you're being asked.
So let me explore the outer edge of your bright line here. Let's say you're in a deposition. Lawyer thinks the client is not, or the deponent is not being forthright or whatever. They get into it. Lawyer grabs the opponent and punches him. Any liability there?
I think the answer is yes. The distinguishing factor is whether the lawyer was providing legal services. And I think that under any reasonable sense of what a lawyer does, that does not include punching someone in a deposition. I think that's different than this case, because when we look at what it's undisputed, and it's Statement of Undisputed Material Fact 48, Attorney Strait is alleged to have done three things: preserve records, advise his client, and offer exhibits at a trial. Those are the things lawyers do. And we hear that forms the basis for the liability here. And I would submit to you, Justice Salter, that is the difference. Fundamentally, when you boil it down, is what the lawyer did based upon the attorney-client relationship and what lawyers do in representing their clients. There's the dichotomy. And that's consistent with what this court has said in ChemAge. So when you look at that, and the undisputed facts here, what we know is undisputed, as the Chief Justice rightly pointed out, most of the facts are largely agreed upon. We know that on December 3, 2014, Attorney Strait met with his then potential client, eventual client, Marianne, for the first time. We know that she had previously consulted with an FBI agent. She had previously consulted with an investigator because she wanted to investigate whether her husband was having an affair. We know that she got a voice-activated recording device and that she was actually placing it in a shop where both of them had access, where both of them worked, where people were coming in and out. And we know that after December 3rd, she's bringing that device to Attorney Strait's office. His staff is downloading it. We also know that by no later than January 8th, he tells her to stop. All of those recordings are produced in discovery. And we know that he offered two excerpts and explained in the offer of proof, as correctly articulated by Justice Kern, why he was offering those exhibits at the trial. Judge Tim made a decision. He excluded them. All of that's undisputed. And with that, what Doug wants to do is take and go back to, you should have told the client during that initial consultation on December 3, hey, you can't do that. You can't record if you're not present. And he wants to take that and repackage that, because that's a malpractice claim. That's a claim he cannot bring as a matter of law. This court is very clear on that. And he wants to repackage that claim under the idea of intentional torts. And that, Justice Jensen, is why we have the problem and why we need the bright line rule. And when you look at it here, there's three claims: invasion of privacy, aiding and abetting, and conspiracy. That's what he's pled. And I want to start with the claim for aiding and abetting, because that's really where the claim against Attorney Strait sounds. And I think it's helpful when you step back, what's the underlying tort here? The underlying tort is invasion of privacy. And as pointed out by counsel, this court has recognized there's three ways you can have three types of conduct that can form the basis for an invasion of privacy. misappropriating someone's identity or their likeness, publication of private affairs, and wrongful intrusion into the private activities. Now, here's where we differ. The claim that was always asserted in this case, and the only claim that's really argued in their briefs, as indicated by their explanation of the elements of invasion of privacy, is the intrusion claim, the act of placing the recorder in the windowsill. There is no publication claim that was ever raised. And that issue is conflated and confused throughout the briefing by the other side. But that distinction matters. Because then the question becomes, can Attorney Strait be liable for allegedly assisting his client in placing that recording device? And I would submit the answer, as conceded by counsel, is ChemAge Industries versus Glover. They never addressed it in the briefs, and they never did because they can't get around the fact that it requires affirmance of summary judgment. And here's the key. When you look at ChemAge, paragraphs 43 and 44, here's the dichotomy that this court was grappling with in recognizing an exception to the privity rule. And that's important because it addresses all the policy issues that this court has used as the basis to say we're not going to deviate from the privity rule. And it says, okay, on the one hand, we've got a lawyer who committed a crime. Let's not forget that. He notarized a document in which people were not present. So his own criminal conduct, independent of his client, assisted his client in breaching a fiduciary duty. And this court said, we're not going to immunize you from that. By the way, it wasn't litigation. It's transactional documents. And I think that matters. And I think that matters because of the fact of the natural adversarial nature of litigation and zealous advocacy. Separately, when you look at paragraph 43 and 44, and here's the important quote in 44. It's a parenthetical quote from the Witzman case. And this court said, substantial assistance means more than providing routine professional services. You have to do something more than acting as a lawyer. It's not good enough. It can't form a basis for liability, as indicated in one of the cited parenthetical cases, to give legal advice. It can't form the basis for aiding and abetting liability to be a scrivener. And then we take that and we look at, what do we have here? First, I would submit, and it's important, this court's never recognized an aiding and abetting case outside the breach of fiduciary duty arena. I would submit that it shouldn't. You're carving away at the privity rule. That's undermining the policy considerations that form the basis of it. We should not extend it to other intentional torts. And the other side has provided you no authority where it's been extended to invasion of privacy claims. Separately, even if this court recognizes that as a viable claim, what do we have in the undisputed facts here? What did Attorney Strait do? He advised his client. That is the penultimate act of a lawyer. It's exactly what they do. Then his staff downloaded the recordings. Now, you can make a reasonable argument that Attorney Strait maybe should have given different advice. Doug Dantvoort can't make that argument because he can't sue for malpractice. But someone could make that argument. I do not think you can make any sort of reasonable argument that Attorney Strait did anything wrong in downloading and keeping and later producing in discovery the recordings. He's got an ethical obligation under 3.4 to maintain anything that might be potential evidence.
So he assisted, but your view is he didn't substantially assist.
Correct. He didn't substantially assist. Well, let me back up. The answer is no, Justice Kern, and here's why. The intrusion occurred at the time of placing. And I think that the temporal distinction matters. It was done by the time she brought the recordings in. So there is no substantial assist, or there's no assistance. Now, regardless, there is no substantial assistance, and it cannot form the basis of liability under the test articulated in ChemAge, because he's doing what a lawyer does. They maintain potential evidence. And then we get to the offering of the exhibits. Now, as Justice Salter pointed out, remember, the claim here is intrusion. It's not publication. It gets conflated in the briefing because they ignore that distinction, that what they always argued before was the intrusion. That had happened months prior, had nothing to do with the trial. And even if they're trying to argue publication, then they have a problem once he walks into the courtroom with the litigation privilege. When you look at what he did, he offered exhibits. They were never played. It's undisputed that they were never played. And then he made an offer of proof. There is nothing that can be more akin to what a litigation lawyer does than offering exhibits at trial. And they were refused. They were refused because the judge determined that they were wrongfully obtained. But that's a judicial decision by the judge, and that's the remedy, is the exclusion. It's not to create liability for lawyers for offering an exhibit. Think about the problems this creates for duties for lawyers. You have a client that wants you to offer something. I have to not only address the concern of, can I get it into evidence? Separately, should I be offering it? Now I also have to worry about whether I'm going to get sued by the other side, who in a divorce case hates my guts. That's why you cannot recognize that as forming the basis of the claim. And when you look at the Gimmel case, here's the distinction that was there in the reply brief in the Gimmel case. And it's important. The Gimmel case said the collecting was non-communicative conduct. So the actual step of collecting isn't immunized. Now, Gimmel also said, it's either Gimmel or maybe in the Toll case, I apologize, I can't remember which one of them, that they were just addressing the issue of the litigation privilege. They weren't addressing whether it was there was an underlying action. Remember, the litigation privilege is a defense. They still have to show that it's actionable. But fundamentally, when you step back, we've never argued that the act of collecting and maintaining was privileged. What we've said is that can't be the basis for liability. And publication in the courtroom can't be the basis of liability because of the issues with the immunity. Separately, on the aspect of the claim for the invasion of privacy itself by Attorney Strait, as I've noted, I mean, the claim is really an intrusion claim. That's the elements they've argued. And Attorney Strait didn't put a recording device in there. That's undisputed. That was all done before, even on the individual instances after he was engaged. He was never physically there. He didn't put it in. That's why these claims are really aiding and abetting claims rather than a direct claim. Separately on the conspiracy claim, when you look at it, Justice Kern, I mean, we provided you the authority of the what I believe is the general rule, which is that a lawyer and the client cannot conspire together as a matter of law, and that makes sense. And I also would suggest it's very much consistent with this court's decision in the Cisney case that we cited in our brief. And here's why. The lawyer's agent, client's a principal. They're one person. By definition, a conspiracy requires a meeting of mind of two people. In the eyes of the law, they're one and the same. And separately, from a policy standpoint, think about the problems this would create if it's recognized that the decisions made when a client and a lawyer consult, make a decision, if that can form the basis of a conspiracy. Is every decision to offer an exhibit like here, which by definition should be discussed between the client and the authority, the basis for liability. In representing clients, lawyers consult with them. That is what they do. That cannot form a separate independent basis, or the privity rule is completely eviscerated. And I would suggest to you here, as you go back and you think about, are we going to extend the aiding and abetting? Is it right to recognize liability when a lawyer is providing typical legal services? Think about the next case. It's not very hard to come up with a scenario where we got a problem. Think about the case in which a lawyer is consulted with a client who has a security interest in a tractor. Another bank's got a security interest. The lawyer says, no, I think you're in first position. You go ahead and you can take that tractor back. You go ahead and foreclose. The other side sues that bank for conversion. Happens all the time. You converted my security interest. Is the lawyer liable for aiding and abetting? That's an intentional tort. conversion. And what did the lawyer do? The lawyer gave legal advice. And what this court has said properly is the only person that has a claim against that lawyer for the mistake is the client. It's not the other side. Ultimately, because the court recognized at the trial level that there is no duty, and the duty issues, the other side wants to ignore them, but the malpractice duty issues are the fundamental underpinning and the lens through which I submit you must view all of these claims. Recognizing additional causes of action would subvert the policy reasons, and as a result, summary judgment should be affirmed on everything. Thank you, Chief.
Thank Justice. You, Mr. Sutton. Mr. Chizinka, you have 10 minutes rebuttal, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
I'd like to start by highlighting something that I think summarizes what lawyers should and should not do. And the California Court of Appeals did that in Kimmel. Quote, "The profession of the law possesses extraordinary powers. Lawyers can make the arrogant humble and the weak strong. In control of the course of litigation and armed with the knowledge of right and wrong, they are the most able to abjure illegal and tortious conduct. It is their duty to do so. As occupants of a high public trust and officers of the court, they are expected to conform their behavior in legal affairs to a higher standard of rectitude and spirit of obedience than those who are willing to endure the dust of transgression. Guided by oath, duty, and obligation, the lawyer's path avoids the vices from which the virtuous abstain. Thus, it ill suits the profession to seek immunity for injuries inflicted while engaged in legal warfare under the protective tarpon of the privilege for judicial proceedings." That's Kimmel at 531. This court and Attorney Strait says that there should be a bright line rule that if the attorney is doing it in the course of litigation, it's fine. Frankly, that's terrifying. It's terrifying at the prospect that an attorney is immune from suit for burglarizing, for working with his client to burglarize the other side, to steal, to cheat, to do all of these terrible things, which would, for any average, everyday person, be absolutely prohibited. But somehow, if they do it, if an attorney commits this tort under the guise of providing legal services, the attorney is immune? The bright line rule is simple. The bright line rule is just avoid committing or actively assisting torts. That's what this court laid down in the Kim H. v. Glover case. And if we look at paragraphs 49 and 50 in Kim H., and I want to highlight this for the court, because like this case, the trial court granted summary judgment to the lawyer, saying that he did not provide active assistance or substantial assistance to the underlying breach of fiduciary duty. This court reversed reasoning that even though all the activities that the attorney did, they're what attorneys do. I mean, the defendant Shea talks about that these are actions that attorneys do. They gather evidence, they litigate cases. Well, the actions of Glover in Kemage are all the things that attorneys do. He notarized documents. He prepared contracts. He consulted with his client regarding a business. This is what transactional lawyers do. Yet this court found that he did provide substantial assistance, or that there was sufficient evidence to submit it to a jury that he provided substantial assistance to his client who had breached his fiduciary duty. And I think that's the parallel here. And I think the argument that Defendant Strait has made is the one that criminal defendants have made unsuccessfully since the beginning of time. I didn't rob the bank. I just drove the getaway car. The robbery would not have been successful but for the getaway car. And here, defendant Strait is the getaway car.
Can you specifically address your opponent's claim that the underlying tort here for the invasion of privacy was only the intrusion and not the publication, and that now you are trying to attempt to expand the claim somehow? What's your response to that?
Well, I think this court has already addressed that in Rothman, Farner, Bakken, where it's what it is just the continuation of the damages as a result of the intrusion. It's part of an ongoing transaction or an ongoing continuing tort of the invasion of privacy. And this invasion of privacy, its objectives wouldn't have been fulfilled, because if we look to what defendant Strait testified about his objectives for publishing this information, or trying to publish this information, was to satisfy his client's emotional need, her emotional needs, not any litigation purpose, not any evidentiary purpose, but for her emotional need to, as he put it, quote, get on with her life. And when I asked him if he could think of any other reason, and if looking at these kinds of cases, any reason why an attorney or why someone would eavesdrop the other party, his answer would be to harass them. Not a litigation purpose. It's not for any valid legal purpose. It's purely to harass and humiliate the other party. And let's not forget about the fact that the recordings that David Strait that tried to introduce into evidence and that he put in his offer of proof was of Doug watching pornography in the privacy of his office and engaging in adult activities with himself. What purpose is that? There isn't one.
So, counsel, just to assure myself that I understand the record, Strait did not attempt to offer the information that you just summarized into evidence. Rather, it was contained within the original exhibit.
That's correct, Judge. That's correct, Justice.
Is that an important point?
I don't...
That information would never have been played to the court. It would have been included in an exhibit if it would have been admitted.
I think that it is still dispositive, because that recording, if you go out to the public record, it's still out there for anyone in the public to obtain. They could, any person out of the public, if they wanted to look, they could sure go get it. And if the more that Ms. Ranchow and Defendant Strait wanted to embarrass and harass Doug, all they had to do was say, hey, go check out the public record in this case. It's a great way to harm someone.
Is harming somebody and harassing them, as unflattering as that is, or anyone to do, is that part and parcel of the intrusion upon somebody's privacy theory that is an issue?
Absolutely, Justice. And I think, you know, this court talked about it in two different cases. First was the Roth v. Farner Bakken case, where there were the three aspects of the damages for the invasion of privacy. One was the actual opening of the mail. Two was the copying of it. And three was the dissemination. But then in Kierstead v. Ravelette, where there was the damage from the initial, where the defendant in that case had viewed women using the bathroom at his office through a peephole, but then the ongoing emotional harm from knowing that that had occurred. That's part of the problem. That's part of the damages in an invasion of privacy, is you can't take that back. And there's a couple of factual issues that I want to correct, because I think there were some factual misstatements by the other side. He keeps on talking about how, you know, this evidence was disclosed and in normal discovery. That's not true. That's not accurate. What happened is that Doug found the recording device. He told his lawyer. And, you know, as those of us who know Karen Crewe, she raised a little trouble to the other side. And only after that, only after both Defendant Strait and Marianne Ranchell got caught red-handed, did they turn over the evidence. And only after they got caught red-handed did she stop recording. And so if we look at it from an encouragement or substantial assistance, this would not have occurred but for Defendant Strait's enablement of that behavior. And he encouraged that behavior by using the evidence and by relying on it throughout the course of this case. I think this is a bright line case where he engaged in tortious conduct in conjunction with his client. I think it's actionable under the Kemage case because it fits squarely within the exception outlined in paragraphs 49 and 50.
Thank you, Mr. Trzenka. Court will be in recess till tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.